Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia, and dedicated to the proposition articulated by Walter Lippmann during World War II that a strong and balanced foreign policy is the necessary shield of our democratic republic. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a Bulwark contributor and a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center. My normal partner in this enterprise, Elliot Cohen, is traveling in Svalbard. He'll be back to report next week, but I'm pleased to have as our special guest this week a colleague of Elliot's and mine from Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, Michael Mandelbaum, who is the Christian A. Herder Professor Emeritus of American Foreign Policy at Zeiss, also the author of 17 books. I once heard Walter LaCour being introduced, Michael, and someone rattled off the number of books he had written, and he said, yes, but the important part is they were all good books. So I'm happy to say that among Michael's very good books are some that I enormously admire. But he's written a new one, and it is The Titans of the 20th Century, How They Made History and the History They Made. Michael, welcome back to Shield of the Republic.
Thank you. It's a pleasure, as always, to be with you, Eric.
So I enjoyed reading this immensely, and not because I'm not familiar with a lot of the material, although there were some things with which I was not familiar. Among the eight titans who you cover are Woodrow Wilson, Vladimir Lenin, Adolf Hitler, Winston Churchill, Franklin Roosevelt, Mohandas Gandhi, David Ben-Gurion, and Mao Zedong. I learned a lot I didn't know about Gandhi, I have to say. This really was, for me, a reminder of the role of individuals in history. And you begin the book quoting Thomas Carlyle about the role of individuals, but also one of my favorite quotations from Marx, which is that individual men make their history, but they don't make it as they will. They make it essentially on basis of the social and economic conditions that they find themselves in. So tell our listeners and viewers, Michael, if you will, how you came to, you know, write this, what process you used for selecting these titans, and how you see the interplay of individuals and you know, the sort of structural forces that they encounter.
Sure. I've spent my career as a political scientist, and political scientists look at politics and history through the lens of large, powerful, impersonal forces. And that's how I've tended to approach the interpretation of politics and history. But historians like you, Eric, tend to look at politics and history from the perspective of the individual. There's not an absolute difference there, but I thought that it would be interesting to look at history through the other end of the telescope and try to assess the role of individuals. Now, the truth is that history is made by the interaction of individuals and broad impersonal forces. But I wanted to look at individuals who could be said to have made an important difference of and by themselves. And I chose these eight because no one would dispute that they had a personal impact on the course of 20th century history. Now, it also is the case, and this is an argument I make in the introduction, that their period, the first half of the 20th century, was the era in all of history when individuals could have the greatest impact. And the reason for that is that this was the era of the two world wars, of the Great Depression, and of decolonization. And those developments were like hurricanes in the geopolitical landscape. They knocked down existing political and economic structures, and they gave individuals the opportunity to build new things. And these eight individuals, in one way or another, had in mind new structures that they wanted to build and were not completely, but in very great measure, successful. So it was a combination of eight men, all of whom were men of ideas and had ideas they wanted to put into practice, and an historical period in which they were able uniquely to do so. And I should add that the subjects are all male because in this period, all the major leaders were men. The careers of Golda Meir and Indira Gandhi and Margaret Thatcher come in the second half of the 20th century. Now, as to your question of who I left out, who I considered but didn't include, one is Kemal Ataturk, the creator of modern Turkey. It's also the case that in the first half of the 20th century, Japan was an extremely important country, but I do not have a Japanese leader because I couldn't find one who had a major individual impact. The obvious omission is Joseph Stalin. Stalin was, if not the architect, the contractor of the Soviet Union. He built the structures of the Soviet Union, and he was the leader of the Soviet Union in World War II. The reason that Stalin is not included, other than the fact that having written about Lenin, Hitler, and Mao, I really didn't have the stomach for another horrible, barbaric mass murderer. But the rationale is that everything Stalin did was foreshadowed and designed by Lenin, who is in the book. Stalin liked to say that he was Lenin's best pupil. And I think that's right. And virtually everything that he did, from the planned economy to the gulags, to the secret police, to the terror, to the tactics he employed in foreign policy, can all be traced back to Lenin. So that's the rationale. And in the chapter on Lenin, I go into some detail on the reasons for omitting Stalin and the sense in which Stalin was simply the son of Lenin.
Yes, I actually kind of was mentally, as I was reading your chapter on Lenin, was thinking about my own graduate school education and you know, sort of, you know, in my head, there was this sort of, you know, mental thing going on of, well, Trotsky said that Stalin was bad, but Lenin was good and revolution under Lenin was good. And then, you know, Stephen Cohen had just published his book on Bukharin, you know, when I was a graduate student. And so, you know, Stephen Cohen's view was that Bukharin was good and, you know, Lenin was bad and Stalin, you know, kept this, you know, communism with a human face from emerging under, you know, under Bukharin. And then, of course, Richard Pipes's work, which says, no, this is all, you know, Lenin is the source of all of this. And you, I think, come down on that side of it, which I happen to personally agree with. It all starts with Lenin, who, as you say, is patient zero for the sort of what I think it was Churchill who called Bolsheviks a bacillus in the body politic that he wanted to extirpate, even though he found himself fighting World War II with Stalin.
Just a footnote on that. One of the great admirers of the Bukharin book was none other than Mikhail Sergeyevich Gorbachev, who had it translated into Russian so that he could read it. And he was on the revisionist side. He believed that things had taken a wrong turn and he would make it right. He would institute communism with a human face. And we saw what happened with that.
Right. I got to live through part of that when I was at the embassy in Moscow from 1987 to 89, which is one reason why the Bukharin thing was in my mind. So, Michael, one of the things that comes out, particularly when you talk about the dictators you cover, Lenin, Hitler, and Mao, but not just with them, with some of the other figures as well, One of the things that struck me as I read it was the role of will and will to power in, you know, in these extraordinary people. Not everybody has it, you know, right? I mean, you might say that Gorbachev, for instance, didn't have it. You know, in the end of the day, he was unwilling to do anything to stay in power, you know, that he might have done. Flirted with it, I think, in 1990 a little bit. But, you know, in the end of the day, he just couldn't do it. But there were other people who were just willing to do anything to accomplish their ends, not allow themselves to be diverted or, you know, put down. How do you sort of assess that as a factor in all of these people?
It was very important, especially for those three, for a particular reason. They were outsiders. They were complete outsiders. There was no political structure in which they could rise. And that wasn't true of Gorbachev. He had an established Communist Party in which he maneuvered to get to the top. There was no established Communist Party in power for Lenin. He created it, or for Mao, who basically created the Chinese version of it. And Hitler, although he came to power completely legally in 1933, tried first to overthrow the German government, or at least the Bavarian government, in the Beer Hall Putsch of 1923. And once he got to power, he swept away all the legal niceties of the Weimar Republic. So these were people of very strong will. And it's, I think, important to note that one of the sources of that strong will, and there were obviously psychological sources to which we don't have complete access, but one of the sources was that they were all men of ideas. They were seized with ideas in which they deeply believed. Lenin was a devoted, convinced Marxist, although he was a Marxist by his definition. And he made several important changes to the Marxist canon. Hitler was an extreme German nationalist and an anti-Semite. And he had ideas that he was determined to put into practice, and he did, to terrible effect. And Mao was, I think, basically a revolutionary. And somebody who, for whom personal power was extremely important, and he gained personal sway over the largest country in the world and put into practice, as I say in the chapter in the Titans of the 20th Century, extraordinarily disruptive policies that no one else would have thought of and almost no one else wanted. And yet he had the power and the willpower to implement the Great Leap Forward and the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution. So all of these people, including and in some ways, especially the dictator, show the importance of will in politics in getting to power from the outside of existing structures and then in implementing sweeping revolutionary changes.
Of course, the intersection of that kind of will with a particular, you know, sets of ideas unchecked by any other countervailing power in all three cases produces, you know, incredibly catastrophic, you know, consequences and essentially mass murder because the lack of sort of guardrails, you know, lead people to great extremes to actually implement these ideas, some of which may just not be implementable or counter to human nature, and result in a lot of pushback that then leads to repression and disaster. Is that a fair summary of those three chapters?
The absence of guardrails is crucial here. The Democrats, whom I portray, did have guardrails, and they never thought of overturning the system in which they came to power. That was true of Woodrow Wilson. It was true of Franklin Roosevelt, who made important changes in American domestic life, but always within a constitutional framework. And it was true of Winston Churchill, who, despite the extreme circumstances in which he found himself as prime minister between 1940 and 1945, always observed parliamentary niceties, always reported to the parliament, never tried to seize dictatorial powers. The interesting exception is David Ben-Gurion, because, of course, he came from the outside. He founded, or was more responsible than anybody else, for founding the State of Israel. He had very sharp elbows as a politician, but he was very scrupulously a Democrat. And he made sure that the State of Israel was democratic from the beginning. And of course, it remains a democracy today, the only democracy in the Middle East. Part of the reason for that is, well, one reason is that he spent time in Britain and the United States. He admired Churchill. He respected democratic norms. He, after all, came originally from Poland, which was not a democracy, although he left as a very young man. But beyond that, the Jewish community in Mandatory Palestine, where he spent most of his life, at least before 1948 in the creation of the State of Israel, and the Jewish community there was governed democratically. The main Zionist organization was the Jewish Agency. The head of that was Chaim Weizmann in London. But the Jewish Agency operated democratically. They had elections, and people who subscribed to the Jewish Agency could vote, which meant that in the 30s, Ben-Gurion campaigned in Poland so that he could be an important member of the Jewish Agency. So he is, in one way, an exception, but in another way, he demonstrates the rule.
You know, one point you make in the discussion of Lenin, which I found fascinating, was the degree to which Lenin has some personal characteristics, paranoia, intolerance of opposition, self-righteousness, a number of characteristics which you suggest he really imprints on the Soviet system, even though, as you pointed out earlier, and as you point out in the book, It's Stalin who's really the general contractor who builds the Soviet state, as it were, but he does it to Leninist specifications, if you will. Want to talk about that for a minute?
Sure. Lenin had two personal characteristics which became embedded in the Soviet Union. One was his view that the ends justify the means, that anything you can do to get or hold power is justified. So, for example, at one point, the Bolsheviks funded themselves by robbing banks. Well, I suppose you could say they were just taking the ill-gotten gains from capitalism. But Lenin lied repeatedly, as you know, Eric, knowing the Soviet Union very well. When the Bolsheviks first seized power in St. Petersburg, they made all kinds of promises. They promised land to the peasants, and peace to the country, and freedom to the non-Russian nations who were part of the Tsarist Empire, with no intention of ever keeping those promises, which they went back on as soon as they could. So that was one point that carried through the Stalinist era and all the way up to the end of the Soviet Union in some sense. The other was that Lenin had a great penchant for violence. He was not a violent person himself. In fact, he was rather timid. He was rather a coward, which, incidentally, Hitler and Mao were not. Hitler led the beer hall putsch. Mao took part in the Long March. He was shot at many times. He wasn't as brave as Chinese communist legend makes him out to be, but he was, in a sense, a soldier. Lenin, when the coup that brought the Bolsheviks to power in St. Petersburg, then the Russian capital in 1917, took place. He was hiding out in Finland, but he believed absolutely in violence and he believed in terrorism. He would say things like, shoot a few of them just to intimidate the others. Terrorism is one of the hallmarks of communism. It started, of course, in the French Revolution with the Jacobins, but the Russians took it to a cosmic level, and that began with Lenin, and Lenin believed in it. Now, having said that, I have to say, especially talking to you, Eric, who knows the Soviet Union and Russia so well, that a penchant for violence and for mendacity did not originate in Russia with the revolution of 1917. There are things that in a different age, we could call Russian national character. And unfortunately, they're still on display with Vladimir Putin. Nonetheless, they were accentuated and aggravated by Lenin.
Yeah, no, some of these things go back to the Romanov dynasty and the nature of the political regime in Russia. Actually, Pipes is very good on that point in discussing Russian patrimonialism and Russia under the old regime. Russia never had a tradition of private property, really. It was, everything was lese majesté at the instance of the Tsar. So
let me add one point there. There was a great debate between Richard Pipes, whose two volumes on the Russian Revolution are magisterial, and his graduate school classmate, Martin Malia, who wrote what I think is the best single book about communism and power called The Soviet Tragedy. Pipes said that Russia was basically non-Western, and that book, Russia Under the Old Regime, is written to make that point. Martin Malia thought that it was the eastern edge of the West, and he wrote a book called Russia Under Western Eyes to make that point. What's interesting about Lenin was that he was very much a man of the West. He lived for 10 years in Western Europe. His entire intellectual being was shaped by a Westerner, Karl Marx from the Rhineland. And not only that, and I say this in the chapter about Lenin, he had a very low opinion of Russians. He didn't think much of them. In fact, he saw himself not as a Russian leader, but as a leader of the proletariat revolution. And he thought that it would then spread to the more advanced parts of the world, especially Germany. And one of his great mistakes was after the Bolsheviks had more or less consolidated power, he insisted on a campaign against Poland because he thought once Soviet troops showed up in Poland, the workers would rise up. Well, the opposite happened. The Polish workers were nationalist and they fended off the Bolsheviks. And this was one of Lenin's great mistakes. But your point about Pipes and about patrimonialism is an interesting and important one. And we see it showing up with Putin again. But the point about Lenin was he didn't believe it, and he tried to roll it back with, of course, no ultimate success.
Yes, and on the terror point, I mean, a point you make, again, on the issue of, inclusion of Stalin or non-inclusion of Stalin, that the one real revision that Stalin makes in Leninism is that whereas Lenin was willing to use terror against all other elements of the society, but not in the party itself against opponents, I mean, he did not murder his political opponents inside the Central Committee or the Politburo of the Russian Communist Party, but Stalin actually did. Stalin actually used terror against his own Bolshevik colleagues.
Yes, that is true. Although in defense of Lenin's commitment to terror and Stalin's fidelity to Leninism, it has to be said that the party was much larger in Stalin's time than it was in Lenin's time. So there were more people to kill.
There certainly is that. In terms of imprints, You start the book with Woodrow Wilson, and you make the point in there. I mean, Wilson, in many ways, tragic figure. He, suffers at least one major stroke, maybe some minor strokes before that, in the peace conference in Paris, certainly afterwards. His big endeavor, peace in our, peace without indemnities that he announces in the 14 points, doesn't survive the Paris Peace Conference. His effort, his compromises on that score in order to get the international organization, the League of Nations that he wants to get, that doesn't, get through the United States Senate, in part because of his own rigidity and unwillingness to compromise with the mild reservationists who had some reservations about the treaty, but were willing to perhaps make a deal with him. But nonetheless, despite his failure, he leaves a lasting imprint on American, foreign policy. Could you talk about that a little bit, the lasting significance?
Sure. I should say for our viewers that each chapter is divided into five parts. The first is the life, which gives the biography of the individual. The second is the times, the larger historical forces that bore on his career. The third is leadership, which is divided into two parts. The first part has to do with his political ideas, and they all had them. The second involves how this person got others to follow him in implementing his ideas. The fourth section is the personal imprint, and there I give my personal judgment on what this person caused to happen that would not have happened, would likely not have happened. Of course, we can never be sure, since this is counterfactual, had he not had the position he did when he did. And then the final and fifth and final section of each chapter is the legacy. And Woodrow Wilson is all legacy. He was a failure as a policymaker. His major effort was to design a peace settlement after World War I that would prevent a repetition of that war. But 20 years later, not entirely because of the defects of that settlement, to be sure, the world was at war again. And his great inspiration and the organization that he believed would prevent war was the League of Nations, which he designed, but he could not get the United States Senate to join. So in what sense does he qualify as a titan of the 20th century? Well, he put on the international agenda a series of ideas about organizing the global international system. And those ideas have become ever more popular since then. I should add, by way of preface here, that those ideas were not entirely original with Wilson. They have deep roots in American history going all the way back to the Revolution. Nonetheless, they are so closely identified with Wilson that they are known as Wilsonianism. And they consist, roughly speaking, of a belief in national self-determination as the basis for sovereignty, and in membership in an international organization among sovereign states, democracy within sovereign states, free trade and limits on armaments, all as a way to preserve peace. The United States, in the 100 years since Wilson passed from the scene, has conducted at least a partly Wilsonian foreign policy. It's never really been the dominant strain in American foreign policy, but it's always been important. It always had to be taken into account by policymakers such as you, Eric. And it has even been adopted by other countries. I think it's fair to say that the foreign policy of the European Union, granted, it's largely a rhetorical foreign policy, but that rhetoric is Wilsonian. So Wilson was a failure in his own lifetime, but his legacy is a very substantial one.
Yeah, I made the comment in the green room that, over my 30-year career as a Foreign Service officer, I became more and more Wilsonian as time went on. I mean, some of that has to do with something you touch on, which is the third wave of democratization that Samuel Huntington identified, beginning in the 70s and 80s with liberalization in Latin America, the collapse of the Soviet bloc in Eastern Europe, et cetera. But even in the Reagan administration in the 80s, the efforts to democratize Haiti and the Philippines, which in some sense, I think, showed the Wilsonian, imprint on what, what we describe as conservative internationalism, since Wilson is the patron saint of liberal internationalism. Even in the Reagan administration, there were strong Wilsonian overtones in those two democratization efforts. And as you point out, Richard Nixon, hung Woodrow Wilson's portrait in the White House when he was there, and may have communed with it in the final days of his presidency, according to Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein. I'm not sure that that's a completely accurate account or not, but he clearly identified with Wilson in some ways, even though he's seen as a classical practitioner of realpolitik.
Yes, the two major strains are so-called realism, power politics, and Wilsonianism. One of the great achievements of Franklin Roosevelt was to merge the two. He was a realist. He understood power. He knew that power politics was the coin of the realm, and he practiced it. After all, he led the United States into and through World War II. But he was enough of a Wilsonian to include Wilsonian elements in his foreign policy, the Atlantic Charter, the creation of the United Nations. And he, of course, had served Woodrow Wilson as Assistant Secretary of the Navy throughout World War I. So American foreign policy since Wilson's time has consistently had both strains, sometimes reinforcing one another, as in World War II and the Cold War, which were waged both for power political reasons, but also to defend political values, but sometimes in conflict, as with our Cold War support for so-called friendly tyrants, countries that were autocratic domestically, but sided with the United States in the contest with the Soviet Union. And I should say that all American presidents since Woodrow Wilson have been somewhat Wilsonian, at least rhetorically Wilsonian. I would say that Richard Nixon was the most realist of them. But in a sense, Ronald Reagan was the most Wilsonian. Not only did he wish to promote democracy, but he wished to abolish all nuclear weapons and seriously tried to do so. Which goes to show you that the partisan perception of the foreign policy of the United States and of these leaders is inaccurate. It's not just incomplete. It sends people seriously astray. The two presidents who seriously wanted to get rid of nuclear weapons, and whether that was ever feasible is, of course, a whole other story, and you had to live through that when you were in government. But the two presidents most alike there were Ronald Reagan and Barack Obama.
You know, one of the things you say about both Churchill and FDR is that they were both probably the most qualified people to take their respective countries into, the crucible of World War II, which was this incredible global conflict, even more terrible than the First World War, which, as you pointed out earlier in the conversation, swept away all sorts of traditional structures around the world. World War II, even more devastating global conflict. talk a little bit about that. I mean, was that just, you know, a stroke of good fortune for democracy? I mean, in both cases, that was it was improbable that they would emerge as leaders. I mean, in the case of Churchill, improbable because up until 1940, his career, you know, arguably would be considered one of failure. I mean, Robert Rhodes James has a book about Churchill up until, you know, up until 1940 that is, you know, I think the subtitle is Portrait of a Failure, a study in failure, because, you know, Churchill had, as you point out in your chapter on him, had crossed party lines twice, which was unheard of. As Chancellor of the Exchequer, he had tied, you know, Britain to the gold standard, which, you know, arguably, you know, made things much worse for the ensuing governments as they tried to deal with the Great Depression. He was in a very small minority during the abdication crisis. Didn't want the king to abdicate. He was very hidebound on the independence of India, a point you make in your chapter on Gandhi. If Churchill had been returned to office in 1949, things might have gone very, very differently. Maybe not forever, but at least for some period of time. Yet, when the war comes in 1940, first Chamberlain brings him back into government, despite the fact that he was perhaps the most astringent critic of Chamberlain's diplomacy at Munich, among the angry young men who made up the sort of opposition to appeasement. And despite the fact that when the crisis comes and Chamberlain has to step down, the initial instinct of the Tory party is to go with, of all people, Halifax, who was the foreign secretary, who was an arch appeaser. So that's on the one hand. On the US side, as you point out, until the spring of 1940, FDR was probably planning to retire, you know, to his place in Georgia after serving two terms, as had been the tradition since George Washington. And he ends up deciding against that and winning a third term against all odds. And he was probably best placed, as was Churchill, because of prior experience, to lead the country through war. Was that just a stroke of good luck, or is there some magic in democracy that makes this happen?
Well, that's a very good question. I would like to think that democracy has a way of finding the man, or maybe someday the woman, to meet the hour. And I do say in discussing Franklin Roosevelt, that he was one of America's three greatest presidents, along with George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. And it's no accident that each of them was commander-in-chief during one of America's three most important wars. And as you say, Roosevelt turned out to be superbly qualified to be the commander-in-chief in World War II. Partly because he'd been in government in a responsible position in World War I. But beyond that, he was very cosmopolitan. He could speak and read French and German and also a little Dutch. And he spent a lot of time in Europe as a child and as a young man. He came from a privileged background, of course. And he was a collector of stamps, but also he loved maps. He loved to pore over maps, and he really had a sense for geopolitics that way. And I would say, as commander-in-chief, he made some decisions that were controversial at the time and have been controversial among historians ever since, but in my view, in retrospect, were the right decisions. For example, he chose to get Lend-Lease passed and to aid the British when they stood alone against Germany in 1940. And then when Hitler attacked the Soviet Union, he sent Lend-Lease supplies to the Soviet Union as well, despite real opposition. There was opposition to aiding the British among the military because they thought the British would lose and the American equipment would be lost. There was opposition to aiding the Soviet Union because of anti-communism, and especially because of the communist war on religion. So the Catholic Church and other religious peoples were against doing anything to help Stalin, not surprisingly. Then after Pearl Harbor, he chose a Europe first strategy, even though the attack had come from Asia, against the strong objections of George Marshall and the other generals. He decided that the first major American military operation should take place in North Africa, and Operation Torch began on November 8th, I think it was, 1942. The general said, this is just a diversion. This is a diversion from the main business of the war, which is getting at Germany as fast and as directly as possible. But Roosevelt decided, which they didn't disagree with, that in 1942, the United States was not equipped to assault the continent, but that the American public had to see its army in action in the calendar year 1942 in order to sustain public support for the war. It seems to me he was probably right. And then he did authorize the great Anglo-American Canadian landing in Europe, in Normandy in northern France, in the middle of 1944, known as D-Day, despite Joseph Stalin's insistence that it come earlier. Roosevelt thought that the Allies were not ready, and despite Churchill's preference for postponing it perhaps indefinitely. So that was the right moment, and of course it succeeded. And on the Western Front, that was the decisive moment of the war. So Roosevelt was a great commander-in-chief. Just one brief word about Churchill. He of course, was just as well qualified, perhaps even more so, because he held a major position. He was First Lord of the Admiralty in World War I. But one other point I think is worth bearing in mind about Churchill coming to power. It's true, the Tories didn't like him. He was not popular. They grudgingly accepted him. Halifax would have been a more popular choice in the Parliamentary Conservative Party, which of course had the right to choose the leader after Chamberlain stepped down. But there is a very important ingredient in that decision that needs to be borne in mind, in part because it seems counterintuitive in our own day. It was decided that to fight the war, there should be a coalition government. And that meant that of the 8 or 9 core members of the cabinet, I think 4 of them were Laborites, including Clement Attlee, the leader of the Labor Party, who was the deputy prime minister, and Ernest Bevin. I can't remember offhand who the others were. And they were much more anti-fascist than the conservatives. And they said that they would not serve with Halifax. So it was Labor that, in effect, put Churchill into that position.
I think Stafford Cripps was maybe one of the others.
Stafford Cripps was, yes, that's right.
It's still pretty amazing, though. And the other thing that you touch on as well is the very first test that Churchill has to undergo is the question of, in the wake of the evacuation of British and the remaining French forces from Dunkirk, after the catastrophic collapse of the French army, the proposition is put before the war cabinet by Halifax that perhaps the United Kingdom should use the good offices of Signor Mussolini. There's a feeler that comes to London from Bastianini, who's the the ambassador, Italian ambassador in London. And Churchill has to very carefully navigate whether or not to respond to this. All of his instincts are not to negotiate, with Hitler. And it's not even clear that there was any negotiation to be had. Very reminiscent of current discussions about whether Zelensky should be negotiating with Putin. You cite the marvelous little book by John Lukacs, 5 Days in May, which recounts this, and it's a lovely little micro history that goes through this process in some detail. And in the end, behind the scenes, it's Neville Chamberlain who stands behind Churchill saying, don't negotiate with this guy. I've negotiated with him twice and it doesn't work out well.
Yes, that moment, certainly given John Lukacs's view, although Michael Howard, as I say in a note in that chapter, also a very eminent historian, didn't think that it would have turned the tide if they had started to negotiate. But Churchill certainly thought it was a slippery slope. And if he thought that if Britain began to negotiate, they couldn't stop. And if they began to negotiate, they would lose the confidence of Roosevelt in the United States. After 1940, Roosevelt sent his emissary, Harry Hopkins, to London, basically to size Churchill up, because the reputation that he had, at least with Roosevelt, who'd met him once long ago, was as a drunk and unreliable. Hopkins was very impressed. He came back and said, this guy will fight. And Roosevelt said, okay, then we're going to support him. But if there had been negotiations, and if the British had slid down the slippery slope, then the United States might have decided just to stay out of Europe and confine itself to the Western Hemisphere. And if that had happened, then in 1941, when the Soviet Union was attacked by Germany, it may well be that the Soviet Union would not have gotten military and economic supplies. And that might well have meant that Hitler could have conquered the Soviet Union, and then he would have won his war. So those 5 days in May were the hinge of history, because even in this era of inflated rhetoric, it's not, given how awful the Nazis were, and given the fact that only Churchill's determination prevented Hitler from winning his European war, it's not really an exaggeration to say that Winston Churchill saved civilization.
Right. Yep. I firmly believe that. One of the things, Michael, when you read your book, I'd be curious of your reaction to this. Certainly my reaction was comparing the substance of these people, these eight people you talk about, compared to the political figures that, you know, have succeeded them. And I would say that across the board. I mean, you know, comparing Gandhi to Narendra Modi, or, you know, David Ben-Gurion to Bibi Netanyahu. I mean, it just seems like, you know, these people were deeply, deeply substantive. You could disagree with their, you know, their judgments and some of the things that they did. You can criticize them, but they seem to have been substantive figures in a way that, contemporary politicians across the board in the United States, Europe, Asia, elsewhere, just don't seem to be. Am I being uncharitable, do you think?
No, I think you're being accurate, although I would note that these eight seem like giants, not only in comparison to the leaders of our day, but in comparison to the leaders of their own day. They were unusual. And as I said before, it was the circumstances, the two world wars, the Depression, decolonization, that gave them the opportunity to be such huge figures. And the fact that they were outsiders, to put it crudely, gave them a lot of time to read. And read they did, and form ideas they did. But there's a difference between them and the most important leaders of the second half of the 20th century. And as a sneak preview, not the next book I'm publishing, but the next but one, is on the equivalent of the Titans in the second half of the 20th century. And they are Harry Truman, Konrad Adenauer, Yoshida Shigeru of Japan, De Gaulle, Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan, Deng Xiaoping and Mikhail Gorbachev. And the difference between the second half of the 20th century and the first half that bears on their leadership is that in the second half, these leaders all were part of a stable bureaucratic system. Even the communists, after all, a communist party in which Mikhail Gorbachev rose to power and that he unintentionally destroyed, had been in power for had been in effect for seven decades. So the room to maneuver was far narrower, and the space to think great thoughts, to propose radical solutions, didn't exist. You wouldn't get to be the leader of any country in the second half of the 20th century proposing the kinds of schemes that the leaders of the first half of the 20th century not only proposed, but in large part implemented. So I think in this case, it is the times, the circumstances in which they had to operate, which has reduced the stature of even the outstanding leaders in our lifetimes.
We're running out of time, but I wanted to sort of conclude our discussion, Michael, by going back to kind of the beginning. We talked about the fact that the eight titans who you talk about in this book are, you know, basically people who built the world that we inhabit. I mean, the sort of post-World War II world is the world we've, you know, lived in and had to, you know, conduct our professional careers in. And yet, in some sense, all of them, you know, failed in a way on their own terms. I mean, we've already talked about Wilson's failure. You know, the Soviet Union that Lenin constructed is no longer, you know, around. Hitler failed, thank God, at enormous cost. But his, you know, his dream of a, you know, race-based 1,000-year German Reich, you know, did not come to, you know, to pass. Churchill, you know, famously said, "I didn't become the king's first minister to preside over the dissolution of the empire," but, you know, that's pretty much precisely, you know, what he did by the time he passed in the mid 1960s. The map of the world was no longer filled with red blotches that had come to stand for Britain's dominions, you know, around the world for those of us of a certain age. FDR hoped that the post-World War II world would be run by the United Nations and a directorate of the big four powers. That obviously didn't happen. Gandhi hoped for a united India, not a partitioned India, and certainly a secular India, not the kind of, you know, BJP India we see today, trending towards authoritarianism, not democracy. Ben-Gurion, I think, although in some sense perhaps the most successful of these eight, still I think would be troubled by the Israel he sees today, you know, the kind of crisis over the role of the Haredim, as well as other elements of Israel that he didn't count on, including the fact that his political party that he founded is completely, you know, disappeared from the political scene, no longer a factor. And Mao, of course, we mentioned as well, was an enormous failure, although Maoism under Xi Jinping may be making a sort of, in a Maoism with a more human face, maybe making a comeback. But, you know, how do you square the fact that in some sense all of them really failed and yet we still are their legatees?
Well, you very deftly summarized the concluding section of all of the eight chapters. I think we are their legatees in the sense that the Cold War grew out of World War II. It was the natural sequel to World War II, and the lesser conflicts, which were so important in the post-Cold War era, all came from the end of European empires, which began in World War I and continued after World War II. The Arab-Israeli conflict is a conflict over the British mandate in Mandatory Palestine. The British got the mandate in 1919. Now, 105 years later, that issue is not settled, and it goes back to that. The failure of almost all of them in one way or another attests to what Samuel Johnson called the vanity of human wishes. I think it was Johnson. And it reminds me of two lines, which I suppose could serve as an epigraph for at least the collected last sections of this book. One is from the Rolling Stones, "You can't always get what you want." And the other is from another controversial British subject, Enoch Powell, who was a politician in the 50s and 60s and was a very important conservative, and then made a very anti-immigrant speech in 1968. And as a result, he was cast out of the conservative inner circle. This was the so-called Rivers of Blood speech in 1968. But and he was a classicist, and he was citing a classical forecast about the Tiber River. "I see much blood in the foaming Tiber." But he did say something which I think is a very arresting observation and is worth bearing in mind, not only in connection with this book, but in politics more generally. He said, "All political careers, unless prematurely interrupted, end in failure."
Well, that seems like an appropriate note to end this episode of Shield of the Republic. Our guest has been Michael Mandelbaum, the author of The Titans of the 20th Century, How They Made History and the History They Made. Michael, we look forward to the second volume on the second half of the 20th century. And perhaps, you know, maybe a third volume on the pygmies of the 21st century.
Eric, thank you very much. It is always a pleasure to be with you and your audience.